Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is September 15th, 2016, and a couple quick topics. I want to modify something I said last week. I was talking about vegetable garden space per person for basically growing all the food necessary to live. And by the way, tonight's main science topic, a continuation of last week, the mathematics of the world population. And this is, tonight I'll be talking more about take the world population and let's do some modification. Let's, and just some experiments. This is based on when I happened to be inside Los Alamos National Laboratory when I was giving some invited talk presentation there. I spent some time with the high energy bomb group, and when I was there, they were doing this is kind of a gross topic for most people, and it really is, but it's a study of mathematics and statistics, something I'm an expert in, but death calculations. And I've done this, for example, with hurricanes that have come through Florida, for example, and other places in the world. And typically the news media downplays the death tolls in any natural disaster. And I don't know why the governments do this, the news media does this. But I have been able to show through statistics and calculations from what I learned on how you do this. And so anyway, tonight what we're going to do is something that I'm sure everybody is actually interested in. You take the world's population and the world population distribution, and you, let's say a natural event happens, like a volcanic eruption or a celestial event of some kind. What is going to happen to the world's population? How is it going to be modified? So anyway, but last week I talked about having vegetable gardens. And then, of course, those vegetable gardens would have corn and other crops that you would feed to chickens. And if you had, a fish pond, you would feed to the fish. But basically, this garden would grow all of the food necessary for you to live. And I made an estimate based on a per person. Say you have a group of four, then you would multiply it by four. If you have a group of 10, you'd multiply it by 10. And you always add some because you don't want to be on the shy end when it comes to, remember, you have to keep seeds for the next year. It's a very difficult process. But I said 1,000 square feet per person. You know, so that would be an area 10 feet by 100 feet or 32 feet by about 35 feet, something like that. But what I thought about after the show ended is if you live in a climate where you could get two crops per year, then you would, of course, divide that in two, that area. So you would have 500 square feet. That's 10 by 50, not such an insurmountable garden area. And if you had an area where you could get three crops per year, you would divide that by three. So now you're down to almost 330 square feet per person. And now they've done something where you can get multiple crops per year. And even if you only get one crop per year, remember back in the pioneer days that people would grow early crops like, spinach and things like that that weather fairly good in the cold weather. They would be planting those very early in the springtime, and they'd have their first crop within a month, maybe by the time May came around, when they were going to plant corn, etc. And so, and of course, early wheat, winter wheat, all of these different types of crops came out of this idea that you plant crops back to backs. And so if you're in an area where you get two crops per year or three crops per year, then what you do is you stagger your planting so that when you pick something, you put a seed in the ground. And so, of course, the ideal situation is if you're in a three-season climate or you have a greenhouse which extends your climate maybe a month, in early in the springtime and a month later there's a thing called hot houses. You take a insulated glass, you build up some dirt, you lay this on there, and that's where you plant your seeds early in the springtime. So at any rate, remember, if you're in a survival setting, you probably are not going to have heat 24/7. Anyway, so I wanted to just mention that when you're calculating garden size, take into consideration if you're going to get more than one crop. And then food drying is the simplest, it's the most beneficial way of saving vegetables, fruits, meat, fish, any type of protein, nuts, you know, whatever you have. Drying is the best. It has the most food value when you bring it back and use it. And of course, that's almost nature's way. Anyway, a lot of topics to cover here. Remember, it was the Incas who developed the process of freeze drying because they lived in a very dry region and they had the high altitudes. So they literally developed, without knowing it, the process of freeze drying food and preserving it. Okay, so anyway, I just wanted to mention that. A few other announcements. I had a posting on my webpage, and I was the Elon Musk rocket blew up on the launch pad. It was actually the payload, and I was going to do an expose on the Russian space program and compare it to the American space program and talk about the demise of, say, Virgin Galactic, the setbacks that have occurred with these private space programs. But then I decided I think this population issue is much more important than going into the stupid things that are going on in this smokescreen space program when the real space program, the Tier 1 space program, you never even see it. So anyway, I decided I really wasn't going to cover that topic. A couple other quick announcements, in case I get to the end of this show and don't have time. I have developed a business, and this is now national. I'm taking it and actually releasing it tonight's show. I actually released it officially on John Moore's show this past Wednesday morning and yesterday morning. And tanks, water tanks, or you could put any kind of fluid in these. These could be used for fish permaculture, aquaculture tanks, etc. And so tanks, plastic tanks. I have from anywhere from 5 gallons to 20,000 gallon tanks available. And these are available in the United States. If you're in Alaska or Hawaii, it's really difficult to ship there. But in the populated areas of Canada, we can also ship there. Also, I have 30 distribution centers around the country where you can pick the tanks up. And I want to encourage people to get water tanks in your house. Don't think you're going to fill, if there's an emergency, don't think that you're going to fill up the bathtub that's full of bacteria and that's going to be your water source. Besides, you need your bathtub to bathe in or whatever. But everybody needs water storage at their house. The tanks are also good for agriculture, for rain catchment, whatever. And then also, if you have a filtration system, you can filter water and store it in the tank for long term, so you have a filtered tank of water. And that, like I say, these are from anywhere from 5 gallons up to 20,000 gallon tanks. And so anyway, I'm not going to say any more now. I didn't want to make this sound like an advertisement because I want to keep this show commercial free. But this is a very important announcement. Go to my webpage. All the information will be there, jmccsci.com. And also, don't forget the paid cast. This week's show on the paid cast is part two of Tesla's Mind. And it's about Tesla's favorite invention, his personal favorite invention of his hundreds and hundreds of over 1,000 patents, the Tesla Turbine. And so it's a wonderful device. And so that show is going to be just packed with information, and I'm going to once again get into Tesla's mind so you could see what's going on in this guy's mind. As a scientist, I can, you know, and also understanding the history of Tesla. So this is a really, really, for me, it's just a really cool show to do. And it's really going to be a wonderful show to for you to listen to. And in October, the part three of Tesla's Mind, and this is an ongoing series that will go on for a long time, I'll be talking about the Wardenclyffe Tower. And then in a future show, I'll be talking about the Tesla weaponry, electric and magnetic weaponry that he developed. So anyway, join that on the webpage also. And okay, so just a topic, a little bit on health, on alkalinity of water. Now, this is very, very important. There's so much misinformation on the internet today that I thought I better talk about this. There are some devices out there that claim they make very high alkalinity water. And I ran this by some people that I trust in the alternative health industry and et cetera. And by the way, my water filters, when the water gets done being filtered, it ends up between a 7.2 and a 7.5 pH, which is slightly alkaline. And that's right where you want it. That's the pH of your brain. And that's really the pH of your body. That's where you want it at. You don't want it too much. And remember, water is water. Water is H2O. Why is it alkaline? Why is it acidic? It's because of what's in the water. It's not some special thing with water. Water is H2O. It's the materials, the other elements that are in the water that give it its alkalinity. So you want minerals in the water, but you don't want very high alkalinity. Now, if somebody's sick and they're very acidic, you may want to put alkaline water in to bring them back to normal, but not as a normal routine drinking high alkaline water. There's regions in South America, there's regions in Texas, there's regions in Mexico where the soil is so alkaline that nothing will grow there. So that kind of tells you something. You want the food, the, you know, the whatever you're putting into your body to be very similar in alkalinity to your body. And so anyway, I just wanted to mention that pH balance in your body is extremely important. You don't want to be acidic. It's very well known that that acidic body is promoting cancer. Cancer grows very nicely in an acidic body. I also want to mention that in this process of gathering information about the alkaline nature of the human body, I met a doctor in Florida. This was a couple years ago now. And we were talking, and he made this comment. He said, over at this hospital, they're killing people. And I thought, that's kind of a strange thing for a doctor to say, and he was very emphatic about it. And I've seen more and more studies now where it's becoming clear that people go in to see a doctor, sometimes for something minor, something that maybe they really feel they have to go see the doctor. But a month or 2 months or 6 months later, they're dead. And you go, what happened? This person was not that sick. And I was neighbor to a guy one time. He was a farmer, very healthy. He was retired. His wife was there. And they lived in the house near me. And the guy had something kind of minor wrong with him. So he went to the doctor and he came home, and I kept seeing him, this guy, just going downhill. And I mean, he was a farmer all his life. He was active. He was always out mowing the lawn, and his wife was always out clipping stuff in the lawn. And, you know, they were both active. But anyway, within 4 months after starting to go to the doctor, the guy was dead. And I'm going, what in the heck's going on here? But I'm starting to see a pattern. So anyway, I was talking with the Terry Tomlinson. She's the head of the Upline, my Upline in Via Viente. And a very, you know, astute person regarding health, alternative health, etc. And she said that there had been a study at the Mayo Clinic, of all places. This is the top-rated clinic, medical clinic in the entire world, the Mayo Brothers. It's located at home base in Rochester, Minnesota. But they did a study of patients, and they realized that in the study, they came to the determination that 30% of the patients were being treated correctly for the ailments that they had. Now, imagine this. 30% of the patients at a top-notch clinic or hospital like Mayo Clinic, only 30% of the patients were being treated correctly for the ailments they had. The other 70% were not. Now, imagine just a regular hospital where the doctors are overworked, they're understaffed, they have a very, you know, difficult schedule, and they're going in making decisions every 5 minutes, a different patient, trying to make decisions on dosages, on medication, on you know, whatever it is. In the amount of error that potentially can happen in the medical community, it's over the top. And so when I go back to this doctor that I knew in Florida, and he's talking about the hospital is killing people up there, he really meant this. He really meant this. And so anyway, I don't have any solution here, but I know as for myself, I don't go to the doctor. If I break my arm, I'm going to go to the doctor. He's going to reset it and put it in a cast and check it, make sure it's not infected or whatever. You know, okay. That's why I'm going to go to a doctor. But when it comes to internal medicine, excuse me, but I personally had a misdiagnosed case in my life, my personal situation. I'm not going to say what it was, but I'll just say in general what it was. I was diagnosed with cancer, and that they wanted me into surgery, chemo, and radiation, like right away. They were going to rush me in. And I didn't, I like, oh man, this is terrible. You know, and it really affects you because you're believing what they're saying. And so I happened to be in another clinic with a friend one day, and it was near closing time. And so I went to the front desk and I thought, you know, maybe I can get a second opinion here. So anyway, I go to the desk, and she goes, well, there's only one doctor here. He's kind of old, but, you know, he's the only doctor. If you want to see him, you can see him. He's available. So, okay, go for it. So I go into the doctor's office, and I sit down, and I start talking to him and telling him what my test results were and things. And he goes, no, no, no. He says, you got an infection. He said, this is misdiagnosed all the time. He said, I guarantee you, you don't have cancer. And I'm like, what? They want to send me to chemo and all this stuff. And, of course, I didn't want to go to chemo or radiation or have surgery. And so here I am, and I'm talking to this guy, and he says, here, take a prescription. He says, you've got an infection, and it's not going to go away by itself. Take this. It's a couple-month dosage of this medicine. And he said, take this for a couple months. Don't stop taking it. He said, you'll see results within a couple days, but don't stop taking it because you want to make sure you completely rid yourself of this infection. So I'm like, okay. I went, got the pills, start taking the pills. And I'm not a big pill person, but that's, you know, okay, that's what this guy said. So I've taken the pills. The symptoms went away in about 3 days, and I kept taking the medication, and it all went away. I didn't have cancer. I was misdiagnosed with having cancer, that they wanted to cut me open and give me chemo and radiation therapy. Misdiagnosed. So anyway, I'm going to go away from that topic. I want to get on to the mathematics of the world population, etc. tonight. Let me see if I have. There's some big storms going on. Taiwan being hit with a major typhoon, the largest 230-mile-an-hour winds, if you can even imagine that, and then moving on to mainland China. On to the main science topic tonight, and there's some audio visuals, or some visuals, I'm sorry, on the web page. Scroll down to the center column, picture of the day, and there's going to be some additional pictures that I'm going to be posting this week in addition to what was posted there last week. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take some maps of the world. I've already got maps of the world with population up. So what we're going to do is we're going to overlay the map of population on top of, say, the volcanoes, the active volcanoes in the world. And then we're going to throw in a few extra, like Yellowstone, which is not on the map listed because it's not an active volcano. But potentially, if something major happened, like a passage of a large comet, nucleus, Planet X type object, those could become active, and so those would then affect large land areas relative to the ability to be habitable. Let's take, for example, continental shelves. We'll be looking at those. We'll be looking at the altitude of land that's near the oceans, how far tsunamis would come in, etc. So what we're going to look for here are areas that might be free of imminent disaster if there was an issue here. And also, I wanted to, before I go on too far, that I see in my notes here, I wanted to correct something I did last week. And this is live radio, so sometimes you make errors. So anyway, I want to correct this. Last week, I was talking about making a stadium in which you take every person in the world, the 7 billion plus people in the world, and you give them a 3-foot by 3-foot area to be in. So this is kind of like a stadium, and you're going to build this stadium so everybody has a seat, kind of like a football stadium, but it's just a big rectangular stadium where everybody has 3 feet, actually 3.2 feet by 3.2 feet, so about 10 square feet per person, and you build this stadium, and you say, how big will a stadium be to fit all the people in the world? 7 billion people. And I mistakenly read off the wrong number last week. I said it would be 480 miles by 480 miles. I'm sorry, that is another figure, but the actual stadium would be 48 miles by 48 miles. That's how big the stadium would be to fit all the people in the world into one spot where they each had basically enough room to put a, you know, yard chair, a lawn chair down and sit. Now, I don't know if I'd want to do that, but that just gives you an idea of what 7 billion people are. If, for example, here's another example. The moon is 250,000 miles away. If you took the people and put them in single file, back to back, in a line, it would stretch, and this is giving each person just enough room to stand so the next person is right in front of them. I mean, literally touching. That's how much space each person has. You would have this line of people would stretch to the moon. Now, can you imagine that? That's 7 billion people. But here's a very interesting figure, and this is the 480 miles by 480 miles. Remember that I said that if you took, how much land area would you need to raise a vegetarian garden for people, an individual, and this is also growing enough to feed the chickens that would be meat for the person, or fish food if they had an aquaculture system or whatever. How much area would you need to feed the world's population given that amount of land? That's 1,000 square foot per person. That is the 480 miles by 480 miles. Now, start to get your brain around this last figure, because this is what is phenomenal. This is truly phenomenal. If you took the 7 billion people in the world, and you said, and you know, we talk about the food shortage, we talk about a water shortage, we talk about, carbon problem or this kind of thing. But let's just look at the food issue today. Should there be starving people in the world? With all of the food that's grown in the, you know, heartland of the USA, in Russia, all the wheat that comes from Russia, all the crops in Europe, and all around the world, we're looking at feeding 7 billion people, and this sounds like a staggering task. But if you took an area 500 miles by 500 miles, this is about the size of Iowa and Nebraska, that much area only, and you farmed that organically, non-GMO, pure vegetables and food and fruit, etc., that area would feed the world with no problem at all. Now, just get your mind around this. An area about twice the size of the state of Iowa could easily feed the world with organic food and then have chickens, etc. This is an absolutely amazing fact. So is there a world food shortage? No. With all of the food that is grown, the high production agriculture, how come there's not enough food in the world to feed 700 or 7 billion people? This is a number that is staggering. It should be super easy to feed all the people in the world. Not only that, but people should be able to feed themselves with local gardening. What's wrong with this picture? Now, I'll tell you how to do these calculations that I've done, and you can repeat them. Let's take the one where you line all the people up to the moon, going to the moon, back to back, line people up in a row. Okay, the moon is 250,000 miles away. You multiply that times the number of feet in a mile, that's 5,280 feet in a mile. That gives you a certain number of feet. You divide that by 7 billion people to see how many feet they get, and it turns out to be 0.18, about 0.2 parts of a foot. And so people would be really, really back to back. I mean, there would be just barely enough for the people to stand in a row back to back and kind of squashed in a sense. But the 7 billion people would stretch, the line of people would stretch to the moon. That's how you make that calculation. Okay, let's do the stadium calculation. You take the 7 billion people in the world, you give them 3.2 feet by 3.2 feet, or about 10 square feet per person, and you make the calculation and find out what the total area is, and you turn that into miles. This is a nice little math problem for people, and you end up with an area about 48 miles by 48 miles. Let's round it off. Let's make it 50 miles by 50 miles. That's the size of your stadium. Remember I said that if you took a cube 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet and you put one person in each cube, the 7 billion people would fill up the Grand Canyon. That'd be one heck of an apartment complex. But this is trying to give you a feel for what 7 billion people are. But if you had organic gardening 1,000 square feet per person and enough to feed the entire world, you would need an area, let's just round it off, an area roughly 500 miles by 500 miles. And you compare this to the entire land area of the world, with China, with Russia, with India, with all of the countries, with Africa, the United States, Canada, and you would have enough food in that area, 500 miles by 500 miles, to feed the entire world easily, very well, organically, non-GMO. Start understanding these concepts. But tonight what we're going to do is we're going to imagine there are natural disasters. And I'm going to talk about volcanoes. I'm going to talk about tsunamis. I'm going to talk about, other types of natural disasters. And we're going to take the overlay of the population, the human population of the Earth. We're going to look at coastal zones. We're going to look at mountainous regions. We're going to look at fertile areas. We're going to look at depleted soil areas. We're going to look at all of the volcanoes erupting at once and where the wind patterns take these. Where are places you surely do not want to be? And I'll be honest with you, there's a few places on Earth that really look okay. So this may surprise you. And there's some places in the United States that look okay, but they're few and far between. Canada fares pretty well in general. And anyway, well, let's start off right now with the volcano map. Let's call it volcano map number one, the very top map. Okay, so as you can see, this is the world map of volcanoes. The red dots are active volcanoes. And or semi-active. Not all of them are active today. There's actually only a handful of these that are very active today. But imagining that any of these could go active at a given time. Now, look at them. They're in very specific locations. Now, if you draw a line right through the middle, let's do this. Let's go to South America off the West Coast. There's a big, big spot though there. That's the Galapagos Islands. They belong to Ecuador, and they're just west of Ecuador. So if you're just to follow, you take the left side of the picture, you see North American continent, then you come down through South America, Mexico, South America. Let's start over. You come through Mexico, Central America, and down the west coast of South America, you see a bundle of volcanoes there on the west side of South America, primarily in Ecuador and Colombia, and then you go west. And out in the middle of the ocean, just a short ways off of the west coast there, where there's kind of a bulge, you see a big red dot, and that's the Galapagos Islands. That's right on the equator. So draw a horizontal line across this volcano map of the world, and that's your equator. And the reason this is important is because in the northern hemisphere, if you go north of there, the winds pretty much, once you get up to around Florida and north of Florida, find Florida, that peninsula that sticks down from the United States, from about Florida on up, the winds blow in the easterly direction all the time. Around the equator, the winds typically blow in the westerly direction all the time. These are called the trade winds. And if you come down to South America, you also see all along the Andes mountain chain, all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, at the very southern tip of South America, you see those volcanoes just lined up one after the other after the other. So at any rate, if you, for example, were east of the band of volcanoes on the west side of South America, then the wind, if those volcanoes erupted, they would be moving westerly over the Pacific Ocean, and you would not notice them that much if you were east of those volcanic eruptions. If you were in Central America, look at all the volcanoes in Central America. Look at going up the west coast of the United States, all of the active volcanoes, up through Alaska, along the Aleutian Islands, going west over to Russia, peninsula of Russia. This is the Kamchatka Peninsula of Russia, and what's actually very interesting here is that the majority of these volcanoes are very short. they're not very tall. The tallest one is maybe around 7,000 feet, or possibly maybe 8,000 feet. So they're not very big. The majority of them are much shorter than that. But there's many of them. There's probably about a dozen major active volcanoes in that region. So anyway, you go over to the right side, and that's where you see that. But you see the entire ring of fire, and down through Indonesia, that's south of China. And I'm just talking about this. If you're not familiar with geography, you should become familiar with these. But now look at central Russia. It's almost devoid of major volcanoes. If you look over to the eastern part of Russia, there's a few up there. But going down into Europe, into Eastern Europe, Western Europe, there's only a couple in Europe. So we're looking at vast amounts of area here that are literally volcano safe. There are areas, the North American continent, look at the Lake Superior and the Great Lakes. They're kind of a greenish color right in the upper part of the North American continent. Not a single volcano. This is the Great Laurentian Cap. And it's considered to be one of the most solid areas on planet Earth, one of the oldest areas. And so, in terms of volcanoes, it's a very solid area. But look to the west of there, and what do you see? You see volcano, volcano, volcano. And there's a map that's, you can pull that up now. And also, I'll be listing some that come from my study of the Yellowstone volcanoes, and it shows the ash pattern from the eruptions of the big eruptions of those volcanoes. So at any rate, I'm going to pull up my own copy here of the Mount St. Helens ash fall, the continental United States, from Mount St. Helens, May 18th, 1980 eruption. And you can see the part of the United States. Now, ash pretty much makes an area, it makes it difficult to grow crops. And so in the very dark region, right to the right side of the red dot where Mount St. Helens is located on the map, and now I want you to go to my webpage. Part of the lecture here is that you see these maps. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and if you don't have time right now, if you're listening, say in your car or whatever, I'll describe these a bit. But the Mount St. Helens ash field goes across all of North Dakota, two-thirds of South Dakota, the western one-fifth of Nebraska, the entire state of Wyoming, and much of the state of Colorado. It covers much of the state of Montana, entire state of Montana, and about two-thirds of the state of Idaho, and, of course, Washington State, where it's located, has the darkest region. And so anyway, this is an area that would be affected by volcanic ash. So what we're looking at here is when you're trying to find a place that's going to be survivable, you don't want to be downwind from major volcanoes. So that's why, in fact, the United States, the northern part of the United States, is very, would be very difficult to survive if we had a Planet X type of event. But the southern United States is very survivable. If you look down, like starting around Missouri, say Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, West Virginia, Virginia, Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, and Arkansas down there, probably Louisiana and Florida, and probably Texas. That group of states would probably fare quite well, even if Yellowstone blew up. Now, that would be a very severe volcano. And by the way, I've been trying, and unsuccessfully, to get an effort going where we drain the water out of Yellowstone Lake. Part of the problem is that modern geologists don't understand that surface water can break down through chasms if there's earthquakes, and if the water gets down and touches the magma, it turns into steam. The three big explosions, supervolcanoes that have come out of Yellowstone Park Volcano, which is a giant lake The lake sits right on top of the caldera, which sits right on top of the volcanic hotspot. If that lake drops down into the magma, believe me, it's going to be all over for probably the entire northern hemisphere. And so that could possibly happen with a Planet X large comet type of passage. And when I remember from my work, you understand that Planet X is not going to look like a big orange ball up in the sky. It's going to look like a planet, or I'm sorry, like a comet. It's going to be a large raging comet. So you have to understand that when I'm talking about Planet X, that's really what we're talking about. And that was like the Venus event where there was an actual pole shift. I talked last week about a pole shift. I'm not going to repeat that, where you don't, if you're trying to, and I'm not saying Planet X is coming or anything like this. I'm just giving people an understanding, and also we can understand historically what happened to the world's population by examining the way the world is today. Okay, so going back to the world volcano map, I'm going to try and wrap this up here. You see that in the equatorial region of the world, Africa has a lot of volcanoes over on the eastern side of Africa. Now, because the winds are going to be blowing westerly, that's going to damage the survivability of all of Central Africa except the eastern tip, the eastern that sits over on the Indian Ocean there. Africa, west of that series of vertical series of volcanoes, would not survive very well if all of these blew off. Now, let's look up at Italy. Italy's western coast is entirely lined with volcanoes, and they go out into the Mediterranean. Remember that the trade winds up there go easterly, so Italy would not be a high survivable area in terms of volcanoes. Let's look at the Indonesia. Let's go down to Indonesia, and basically the ring of islands, Java, Sumatra, etc., and then through Micronesia, etc., and going up north almost to Japan. There's a big ring of volcanoes there. That entire area, and if you remember from my book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, that is where, right in the middle of that in the South China Sea, is where the sunken island of Atlantis lies. And the entrance to Atlantis was the cut between Sumatra, off the coast of Sumatra, where Krakatoa is. Krakatoa and its sister volcano were the Pillars of Hercules. That's where you entered into the shallow basin ocean or sea that was surrounding Atlantis, the mother city of Atlantis. And of course, there were small colonies of Atlantis all over the world at that time. And so there's been a lot of mistaken identities of different things being Atlantis. But Atlantis had a lot of colonies, of which they say Egypt was one of them. And so advanced technology, use of magnetic fields, electromagnetic fields, and also the ability to tap into the vertical electric field like Tesla was doing to garner electrical energy, the use of energy beams, the use of directed energy beams and directed energy weapons were something that were used in Atlantis, according to the historic tales. Okay, so at any rate, looking from the world in the volcanic sense, you can start to see the places on planet Earth that would be survivable in the case. In fact, let's look at the Amazon region, the Amazon Basin, South America, very survivable. In fact, most of South America would be very survivable. The southeastern states of the United States, very survivable. The majority of Canada, especially eastern Canada and northeastern Canada, Nova Scotia, the area north of Maine, probably Maine would be very survivable. The northeastern states of the United States. It depends on how far those ash fields would go. It's very difficult to say. Now, the one thing you can also notice here is that Iceland is laden with volcanoes, and when those babies go off, they affect Northern Europe tremendously. And so Northern Europe, the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark in Northern Europe, and north of there, Northern Russia, Siberia, might be affected drastically if those volcanoes went off. Okay, so at any rate, look at India. India really does not have a lot of volcanic activity. So, and that's one reason why. Now look at China, look at India. If you want to understand the ancients, when Venus came through the solar system, there was a decimation of the Earth population. But look at China, look at India, and look at the world population maps from last week. And you see that the survivability in those countries, the main population centers in the north, was where the populations grew very quickly after the great disaster, but they were immune from any volcanic activity. They were immune from tsunamis from the ocean. That's why those populations fared very well after the major disasters. They were fertile. They could grow crops there. Agriculture was something that started. So those cultures prospered very quickly after the ancient events, the Venus event, where we had tidal waves, where we had volcanoes going off, where we had influx of oil from basically the burning naphtha, fire, brimstone, and fire, as they call it, but was the burning naphtha that came in from the comet tail, and also the Great Flood. They were in an elevated region there where they could survive in the mountains, and then as soon as it was over and the water subsided, the ocean levels rose a few hundred feet, but still they had plenty of fertile land there to come out, start growing crops, and that's why those regions of the world have pushing 1.5 billion people each now, because they were the very first to recover. And Africa, of course, the United States was devastated because it's mainly plains, literally, and the Indians talk about that too, the natives, they talk about the tsunamis washing across the plains. The natives of Mexico talk about the tsunamis. You look at, say, the Yucatan Peninsula, where the Mayans prospered, and the Olmecs in South America. You look at the various civilizations that came out of South America, Central America, and Southern Mexico. They survived because they had mountainous regions where they could survive and then come out and populate these areas. But they didn't have the volcanic factor. They didn't have the tsunami factor, except for, of course, Yucatan is a very flat place. And for example, the Colburn, the Mayan Popol Vuh talk about Quetzalcoatl. In the Popol Vuh, they talk about Quetzalcoatl carrying the oceans on his back and devastating the land. And that's one of the personifications of Quetzalcoatl, is the tidal waves that were associated. And of course, Quetzalcoatl is associated with Venus, the plumed serpent god of the night sky. And the Quetzalcoatl heart became the planet Venus, is the legend. And of course, that is the comet turning into the planet as the tail drag circularized the comet orbit. So you have to put all of this together. So anyway, looking at the world volcanic map is very important, because not only do we understand why survivability was possible back in the, you know, the Venus disaster days of Earth, but why it would be also important today. Okay, so now what we're going to do is take a look at the ocean levels and the world topography. So go to the topo map of the world, and let me just pull my map up here so I can take a look at it. And once again, if you're in a car listening, or if you don't have access to these, I encourage you to go to my webpage and listen to this show again. Every show from now on will have more audio visuals, so that you can associate the lecture with some visuals. Okay, now here's another exercise, and kids like to do this. I like to show this to kids to show them the properties of a pole shift. If you take the globe of the world, and I hope everybody has a globe in their house so that you can see this, take the globe of the world and remove it from its stand. Put your fingers, your first finger on one hand on the north pole where the pin was in the globe, and put your left finger, first finger, on the south pole. And you can spin the globe slowly, and you can, right in the center, that line around the middle is the equator. Okay, now what we're going to do is exhibit how to look at the world in light of the pole shift that occurred when Venus came by. Excuse me. When Venus came by Earth, you know, within the last 10,000 years, put the right finger that was at the North Pole, put it in the state of Ontario, the province of Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. And then put your left finger on the opposite side of the globe so it balances. Now turn it, and what you're going to see is that the South China Sea cuts across the equator in both cases. There are two places on the globe that this happens. And so what this tells you is that before the pole shift and after the pole shift, these are other factors that deal with China and India, they were very near the equator. And so what that tells you is they didn't shift into a very much different climate. So the plant life prospered. Imagine that if, like in the North American, in the case of Siberia, which was a very moderate temperature climate at the time, shifting into a frigid Arctic temperature in a matter of literally hours in one night. That's how fast the Earth shifted. And so all of the plant life that was growing there was no longer viable there. That's why the mastodons were found frozen, standing up on all four, flash frozen, with undigested semi-tropical plants in their throats because they were shifted that fast. And so anyway, the point here is that if you do this little exercise, the old North Pole was just north of the state of Michigan in Canada. And the South Pole was near an island in the South Indian Ocean called McDonald Island. It's easy to find on the globe. It's an individual island down there, and that's where the old South Pole was. You also see that what is now Antarctica, which has a land base under it, was in a more temperate climate, so it would not have had the ice cap. And the North Polar region, what is the North Polar region now, would have been in a temperate climate. So that was open for transit from the old Phoenician mariners used to go there. The map that Columbus had, the what known as the Perry Rees map, has the coastline of South America on it, exactly as seen from satellite radar imagery. And Columbus could not have known this. He couldn't have come along and mapped it or whatever. It was a map that he got from was passed down to him from ancient Phoenician mariners. So the world was a very different place, and all of this points to the fact that China and India fared very well. So they didn't have the volcanic problem. They had a lot of highland. If you look at the world topo map, there's a lot of mountainous region in India, in the region and in China, where the high population centers are. And so they fared quite well. They didn't have the volcano problem. They didn't have the tsunami problem. And they did not have a big change in climate. So the plant life that was there, the plants that they grew for food, fared quite well. Look at all the factors that favored the population to rekindle there very quickly. And look at other parts of the world that did not fare very well due to that. So I could go into this and examine the whole world piece by piece, but I wanted to point out China and India specifically, and that's why they have such large population bases today. Okay, so at any rate, now what we're going to do is we're going to look at coastal areas. Let's come over to the North American continent, find Florida and the Gulf of Mexico, and around through the Yucatan Peninsula, and around the east side of Florida, all the way up the eastern side of the United States, all the way up to Nova Scotia. And these are the banks, the Great Banks. That's where all the fishing occurs. It's a very fertile area for fishing. But that used to all be above water before the Great Flood. And there was a increase in ocean level during the Venus event, and there was a great increase in ocean level during the Noah's Flood, which was thousands of years earlier, which also was the encounter with a large comet, where we spent 40 days and 40 nights in the tail of a large comet. Okay, so look at the continental shelf. That's kind of the grayish area that sits off of the continental United States. And you'll notice on the west coast, of going from Alaska all the way down to California by the Baja, western side of Mexico down through Central America, all the way down South America, the western coast drops off like a rock. It's deep, and there's no continental shelf. And so what happened, and this is what Velikovsky reported also, is they found seashells high in the Andes Mountains. Well, why did they find seashells? Because when the oceans of the world were sloshing back and forth, creating these mammoth tidal waves, they were throwing water up high into the mountains, into the Andes Mountains. But there again, this was blocked. The Amazon region was a very fertile region, and the populations did succeed there. The Incas, the Maya, the precursors to those civilizations survived, and that's why when Columbus came, South America was a fairly well-populated region. And so they had a fairly fertile ground, etc. So let's do an analysis on where South America fared in all of this pole shift. So if you follow the equator around on your globe, it's very difficult to do this on a flat map. So you have to do this little exercise with a globe. You find that South America was the other crossing point for the old equator. And so all the way through that, that's why the Incas, the Mayas survived quite well and were the population centers for the what later became the populations in the United States in the Southwest. So the indigenous populations of the United States, especially in the Southwest, etc., did not come across the Bering Strait. They came from the south. That's where the population centers survived. But of course, in standard textbooks, you don't learn this. I'm running out of time here. I might have to continue this next week. But remember, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. The red letter sale on water filters is still on. Look for the new sale on tanks, water tanks. And also join the paid cast this week on Tesla's Mind Part 2. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.